Hello, this is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Luke Ford.
Hi, Robert.
Luke, it's great having you back on.
It's good to be back.
So, what have you been up to lately?
I've been really interested in this Ann Coulter controversy during the last Republican debate on Wednesday night. She kind of started moving outside the Overton window of permissible discourse. She started just by saying there all these guys are mentioning Israel in their response when they're asked, what will America look like after your president? So that's, you know, as Richard Spencer would say, that's a little naughty. And then she blew windows off when she said, how many effing Jews these people think there are in the United States.
Were you having, like, a panic attack and, like, worrying about, like, her language, like, creating the next Holocaust?
No. I only found out about her language, you know, later that night, I think probably the next morning. And I read allusions to it on the Steve Saylor blog comments. And so then I was interested, but I was jarred by her saying, how many effing Jews do these people think there are in the United States? I'll admit that jarred me. Like, the effing word is not a word that you hear in polite discourse. It's not a word you hear in typical political commentary on, you know, on TV or by the main talking heads. So,
what's Twitter? That's different.
Yes and no, but like if the Pope said, you know, how many effing Jews do people think there are in the United States? You go, you know, holy hell. Or, you know, someone, and could not use the F word, commonly to my knowledge, so that she would suddenly throw in this, you know, very strong epithet when talking about Jews. It did, you know, it did snap my head back and made me think, huh, you know, that's just weird. You know, when you encounter something that's disturbing and you haven't been able to make sense of it, that's kind of how I went through my day, you know, the day after Ann Coulter's tweet. I heard something disturbing, but I wasn't able to, you know, make sense of it. It was, you know, it'd be a little bit like if my, you know, mother or father, you know, used the F word. They never used the F word. So if they suddenly, you know, called me up and said, hey, you effing Jew, you know, I would be shocked. I would be, you know, I'd be knocked off my axis. And I'd be thinking, you know, what's going on here? And then as I started talking to friends, then I started to be able to, you know, formulate theories and ideas and responses. And then, you know, I was able to start commenting about it and looking for the most interesting comments about Ann Coulter and the Jews.
Because she was, like, such a major figure within the mainstream conservative movement back in the early 2000s, back in the Bush era. And she's always been extremely pro-Israel, but at the same time, she's been known for saying provocative things. A while back, she made that comment that Jews would be perfected if they became Christians. And in her book, Adios America, she has a whole chapter praising Israel for their immigration policy. So part of it, I think, is because she's a shock jock and she wants to get attention. But also, I think she is annoyed by the hypocrisy, because all the candidates are pandering. They're all pandering on the issue of Israel, but at the same time, they're not talking about our country's sovereignty. And you have someone like Sheldon Adelson who simultaneously lobbies Republican candidates to be pro-Israel, but also to be for open borders. I mean, were you following the Republican debate?
Yeah, I was following the Republican debate, and I'm not generally much interested in what politicians say. I find them boring. So Donald Trump is a breath of fresh air. But, you know, I can't say that I was, you know, filled with goosebumps during the Republican debate. It was, you know, it was okay, but it wasn't exciting for me. And, you know, when they made their incantations of Israel, I didn't think one way or another. I just, you know, become kind of numb through that whole 3-hour debate. And I've become kind of numb to how politicians talk, and particularly how they talk about Israel. So nothing really made much of an impression on me during the debate.
What have been some of the reactions to In Culture that you have been following from prominent Jews and from the media?
Well, I mean, let's be honest, the media is the Jewish media. I mean, let's, just as when you watch, you know, the NBA, it's 70% black. Well, the media is not 70% Jewish, but Jews do kind of set the parameters of what is acceptable to say in the mainstream media. And, you know, as Joel Stein wrote about Hollywood for the Los Angeles Times in 2007, it is a Jewish industry, and the mainstream media is a Jewish industry. So that's why there's rarely any significant daylight between what prominent Jews say and the voices that you hear in the mainstream media. So the coverage of Ann Coulter's remarks were just universally negative. I can't think of any prominent Jews or any prominent people in the media speaking up for Ann Coulter. Like, there was just universal condemnation. So the only person that I can think of defending Ann Coulter was Mickey Kaus. But aside from that, there was no one defending her. So, you know, remember, most 80% of Jews in America vote Democrat. So they just have an instinctive, you know, fear and hatred for the right. For historical reasons, Jews have always sided with the coalition of the fringe against the core, the white core in the West. So, you know, white people tend to vote Republican, and, you know, homosexuals, blacks, Puerto Ricans, you know, Mexicans, Asians, Jews tend to vote left for the coalition of the fringe. So Jews instinctively fear and distrust, you know, people like Ann Coulter, anyone who's got a strong nationalism, anyone who's strongly identified with Christianity, anyone who's strongly identified with, you know, a racial identity, makes Jews nervous. So Coulter makes Jews nervous, you know, generally speaking, for all those reasons. So even though she's pro-Israel, you know, she's unabashedly Christian, you know, she leads the fight against illegal immigration. She wrote a beautiful obituary for Joseph Sobran, and official jury, you know, considered Joseph Sobran, you know, way beyond the pale, you know, an anti-Semite. And, I think it comes down to what organized jury, which the mainstream media is part of organized jury, will not tolerate and will not abide as any public discourse about Jewish power and Jewish influence. So as soon as you do that, you become, you know, persona non grata, and there will be an all-out assault to completely destroy and marginalize you. So I think that's the most important thing about what Ann Coulter did in her tweets, was that she drew attention to Jewish influence. And organized Jewry is, which means the mainstream media, is very afraid of that. So you'll notice in articles that talk about, you know, more diversity in Hollywood, it's never more diversity for non-Jews. It's never, oh, you know, we have to limit the number of Jews who are running things in Hollywood. It's always about, you know, these petty issues of, you know, dividing up places for the goyim in Hollywood, you know, how many, you know, non-Jewish whites, how many blacks, women, etc. So I think that the main issue is drawing attention to Jewish power and Jewish influence, which there is in some areas of American life, there is significant Jewish power and Jewish influence, just as in some areas of Jewish life, there's very significant black power and black influence. And in other areas of American life, there's a very significant Saudi lobby. In other areas of life, or of the world, you know, China has enormous power. Well, you know, the Japanese have enormous power. So depending on how you look at the world or what parts of reality you look at, you know, any one of these groups that I've just mentioned, you can talk about their power and influence. So Jews tend to have disproportionate power and influence in, lobbying, in finance, in the media. Saudis, for instance, have very formidable influence with their money and with the educational professorships that they've bought with their, you know, with their lobbying behind the scenes. You know, there's a very significant Saudi lobby. There's a very significant China lobby. And China exercises a lot of power in the world today. It exercises a lot of power in the United States. So from my perspective, Jewish power and influence, just like Chinese power and influence and black power and influence and Saudi power and influence, are all legitimate topics for discussion. They're things that I've been talking about on my blog for years. And, you know, I welcome Ann Coulter's tweets upon reflection for bringing up that topic. You know, the F word, you know, it does bother me. Someone come from a Seventh-day Adventist background, you know, a preacher's kid. You know, I admit that that does jar me. It, you know, kind of lowers the quality of the discourse. And I bet she was drunk. I bet that she was drunk. I respect that she's not backing down and apologizing, and I'm glad she's not, but my bet is that she was drunk when she read that.
Well, it's interesting to see if she'll be able to survive this, because people like Joe Sobron and people like Pat Buchanan, who have been marginalized in the past, they already were sort of outside of mainstream conservatism, but what's interesting about Ann Coulter is she has this very strong base of following among mainstream conservatives. So I think it will harm her. I think she will get disinvited to media venues. But at the same time, I think she will continue to be selling books, and I think she'll still have a lot of publicity and a strong following.
Yeah, I have no idea what will happen. So let's say that she survives this regular, you know, without a lot of, you know, loss of income, without, you know, without being driven from polite society. Let's say she, you know, she survives this as well as Tony Romo, the quarterback of the Dallas Cowboys, survives his broken clavicle. You know, he's out for about 8 games, and then, you know, let's say he goes on to a regular normal career after that injury, and you know, then he survives it. So if Ann Coulter survives this, then it shows that the Jewish influence in the media and Jewish power over America, you know, is definitely in decline. So then, you know, I expect you'll have a lot more anti-Jewish, or the Overton window will be expanded to cover, you know, a lot more topics that are presently forbidden to talk about, such as Jewish influence and power. So if she survives, then you know, then the floodgates may open to much more biting criticism of Jews, to, you know, hatred of Jews, or to just much more open discussion of Jewish power than has ever happened, you know, in America, at least in the last 60, 70 years.
I saw something funny, which I think you linked to, but the blogger Roosh posted this thing on Twitter that he said, Israel and Hungary prove that borders do work. And someone actually forwarded it to the Anti-Defamation League, and they reported it for cyber hate.
Yeah, so there is, you know, a ridiculousness of, on the part of some Jewish activists in the ADL and Simon Wiesenthal Center, that just, you know, knee-jerk, anything that looks anti-Jewish, you know, we're going to call it hate. And so it's, you know, it's laughable, and it's kind of hard to fathom for, you know, someone coming from a white Protestant background. You know, we didn't, you know, think this way. We didn't, you know, walk around with this chip on our shoulder that, you know, the slightest impoliteness to us, or the slightest criticism, or the slightest awkward pointing out of, inconvenient facts generate the hate comments.
Both Coulter and Roosh were praising Israel for proving that walls around your country work in keeping people out.
Well, that's a very awkward thing for Jewish activist groups. So groups such as the Anti-Defamation League and Simon Wiesenthal Center and Southern Poverty Law Center, they're really Jewish nationalist groups. and Jews love nationalism for Jews, but Gentile forms of nationalism make them very, very nervous, because Gentile forms of nationalism, by definition, exclude Jews. And so Jewish organizations in the diaspora typically push policies on the non-Jews that are very opposite of what Jews seek for themselves. Jewish groups seek for Jews increased strength and cohesion and, you know, strong boundaries between them and non-Jews, strong borders for Israel and increasingly Jewish Israel and helping Jews to more and more strongly identify as Jewish and live their lives in a traditional Jewish way. That's the agenda of Jewish organizations for Jews. But for non-Jews, their agenda is the very opposite. It's multiculturalism, you know, tolerance for diversity, you know, up with homos and trannies, you know, open borders, you know, nation states don't mean much. You shouldn't be, you know, too strong on your racial, religious, or national identities because that's, you know, bigoted. And so it's kind of a sick game that the major Jewish groups are playing, where they consistently push the very opposite policies on non-Jews that they push on Jews.
So the Donald Trump phenomenon is huge, and he's now the Republican front runner. And it's interesting to see the reactions to him, because you did a post, Ann Coulter and Donald Trump, and there are some similarities. So, first of all, Donald Trump is someone who is, he is pro-Israel, but he doesn't pander, slavishly the same way that, the other candidates do. And, you've also done some posts that say a lot of the Jewish organizations, including the, like, Republican Jewish Coalition, are not crazy about Donald Trump, because they see him as, they almost see him as sort of like a fascistic figure.
Yeah, see, it doesn't matter for these Jewish organizations and professional Jews how pro-Israel Donald Trump is or how pro-Jewish Donald Trump is. His daughter Ivanka converted to Orthodox Judaism to marry a very prominent Jew, Jared Kushner. You know, what matters is that support for Donald Trump and what he represents is a resurgence of American nationalism. And the idea that America is a distinct nation with borders that deserve protection. And this talk makes professional Jews, you know, Jewish activists, the leaders of the major Jewish organizations, very nervous, because if there's a revival of American nationalism, then that may well come to exclude Jews. For instance, if there's a revival of white America, so that white people develop a coherent and powerful sense of themselves as a distinct group of people with a special, unique gifts to give to the world, with their own type of civilization, and with a lot to be proud of in being white, then that could cause Jews to be excluded. Jews, I was arguing about this, on the Sabbath, and a friend told me, well, what do you know, you stupid white supremacist? And I said to him, well, you're white. He said, no, I'm not white. And I said, come on, you and other Jews are playing a game. You identify as white when that serves your interests, such as if there's like anti-white, discrimination, such as in the American South prior to the Civil War. You know, then you identify as white. You say, you know, you should let us into your country, we Jews, because we're also white. But then in today's society, where you get, you know, these victim points for not being white, then Jews will identify, we're not white, you know, we have a history of oppression, because that's an advantage. And I don't blame Jews for taking advantage.
Couldn't you make the same argument with white Hispanics? I mean, look at someone like Jorge Ramos.
Yeah, but they're, you know, they don't really, they're a very unimpressive bunch, you know, in general. You know, they're, you know, more Latinos in Los Angeles than non-Latino whites. But, you know, what do they do? You know, they haven't, you know, built even their own college, you know, their own hospitals, that, you know, they're the most low achieving no group around. You know, blacks at least are very impressive pop culture figures. So, yeah, Hispanics, you know, are learning to play, you know, the victim game and say, you know, we're not white. People have historically been marginalized. But Donald Trump represents a resurgence of American nationalism and of white identity. And even though he doesn't talk about white identity, that is something that he represents. And you can see that his support comes, generally speaking, from less educated whites. And, you know, they are overwhelmingly going for Donald Trump. They've been the ones who've been most hurt by this tidal wave of immigration. And so these people make Jews very nervous. And so Jews have always, you know, tried to foster ties with the elites, you know, whether it's the monarchy in a state or religious leaders in a state or the nobility in a state. And Jews have always instinctively feared populism, because, you know, the average Joe has often had, you know, beefs against Jews. He resents them for many different things. And so Jews would look to elites to take care of them. And even today, you know, Jews donate a lot of money to politicians. Jews have a lot of energy and drive, and so they can be very useful enemies, and they're very useful allies, and they're very dangerous friends. So, you know, Jews will try to cultivate, you know, friends in high places. And Donald Trump represents a populist white upswelling of nationalism and distinct national identity and strong borders for America that will, you know, no matter what Donald Trump does, at least 70% of Jews and almost all major Jewish organizations will be against him and will, you know, try to destroy him.
I was reading an article that what the article was saying is the majority of Jews have a negative opinion of Trump, but the Orthodox are the one exception.
Yeah, that would make sense. So Orthodox Jews vote Republican. And the more Orthodox they are, the more traditional they are, you know, the less interest they have in civil rights and gay rights and tranny rights and rights for immigrants and rights for non-whites. You know, they don't care about any of that stuff. So among traditional Orthodox Jews, you know, they would generally speaking be fine with Donald Trump. But Orthodox Jews are only somewhere around 12% of American Jewry. So at least 70% of American Jews, I would suspect, are not going to vote for Donald Trump and would have negative views of Donald Trump becoming president.
Also, he's talked about raising taxes on hedge funds, which is pretty remarkable for a Republican candidate.
Yeah, he's unlike any political candidate I ever remember. He's unlike any major Republican candidate I ever remember. He's got a populist agenda, and this frightens Jews, of course. You know, the major hedge funders, you know, I'm sure at least half of them are Jewish, and so raising taxes on hedge funds or pointing out how the 1% are perhaps, you know, not paying their fair share of taxes, that's going to make Jews very nervous, because of the 1% richest people in the United States, I'm sure, you know, somewhere around a half or more are Jews. So the what was that movement, Occupy Wall Street? Didn't they point out the 1%?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
That made, you know, Jews in the media and professional Jews very nervous, because, you know, that 1% that they were against was, you know, half Jewish.
Well, Bernie Sanders is Jewish, and he's making a lot of the same arguments.
Yeah, he has a kind of a populist socialist take. So he would get, if he gets the Democratic nomination, he would get, you know, at least 70% of the Jewish vote.
So you have this other post, Philip Weiss, Coulter's point is that the Republicans pandered to Israel to win donors, not voters. So, some people were speculating they were pandering to the evangelicals, but the point Phil Weiss was basically making is they're basically speaking to these major donors like Sheldon Adelson.
Yeah, that's a provocative point. Like, it's not easy for me as a Zionist to read Philip Weiss and Mondo Weiss, but he often does have very thoughtful critiques of Jews and Jewish influence and power and of Israel. So I'm a Zionist. I love Israel. But Philip Weiss, you know, does often put his finger on things, and he seems to be doing it here. You know, Jews, the big Jewish donors account for probably 2/3, 3/4 of money raised for Democrats. That's a widely thrown around term based on studies of donations by Jewish political scientists. And then they probably account for at least 25% of Republican money. I'm sure it's now, you know, closer to 50%. So, you know, money is the lifeblood of politics, and Jews provide much of the money that keeps a political campaign going. So there are a lot of incentives for candidates to appease their Jewish donors.
Before you got, like, openly into the, like, white nationalist type stuff, were you really close with the Republican Jewish Committee?
The Republican Jewish Coalition.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was a member of it for years. I went to many of their events, and I feel, you know, pretty sympathetic to much of what they're doing, you know, to bring Jews into the Republican Party. I think that's wonderful. What I don't like is when they try to pull the Republican Party in a non-conservative direction, so away from immigration enforcement and, you know, away from what are traditional right-wing positions. So that's kind of the downside of the Republican coalition.
It seems their main concerns are, well, obviously Israel, but also lower taxes for the rich. But basically on every other issue, they're fairly liberal. I mean, they tend to be much more pro-immigration than regular conservatives.
Yeah, the neoconservative movement is a fundamentally a Jewish movement, even though you can point out non-Jews in the movement. It is a creation of Jews, and it has taken over both the conservative movement and the Republican Party and pushed them both way to the left. So all sorts of ideas that were regarded as left-wing, such as that, you know, the United States should fight for, you know, democracy, you know, around the world, have now become talking points of the Republican Party. Paul Gottfried points this out much more eloquently than I do. And so what's happened with the neoconservatives taking over National Review and taking over the conservative movement and the Republican Party is that the things that were traditionally right-wing have been done away with. Traditionally, probably the defining characteristic of on the right is that you do not believe in equality. You believe that, you know, different people have different gifts and you don't believe that everybody should just be the same. So this belief in equality has now taken over the conservative movement, has taken over National Review, and you know, this notion that there's no, you know, important genetic differences between races and peoples is, you know, a left-wing idea. It's not a right-wing idea, but it's taken over the American conservative movement. It's taken over the American Republican Party, and much of this has to do with Jewish neocons or Jews moving into and hijacking the conservative movement and the Republican Party and moving it to the left.
How do the Jewish organizations stand on bringing in the refugees from the Middle East?
Well, Jewish organizations are universally for more immigration because it waters down white identity. So making, you know, a cohesive, strong, white country, you know, less and less possible, instead turning it into a brown country so that Jews don't have to fear another Holocaust. So Jewish organizations have always pushed for over 120 years for more and more immigration. And, you know, they may frame it as compassion for the immigrant, or they may frame it in any, you know, universal moralistic language that they think will be effective. But the point is to make their host country more user-friendly for Jews, more of a safe place for Jews. So from the perspective of all major Jewish organizations, if you bring in a bunch of immigrants and you, know, you water down the host country's racial, national, and religious identity and turn the country into a melting pot, that Jews won't stand out as much for being different, and that Jews will then be able to house train all these new immigrant groups, such as Latinos and Muslims, to not be anti-Semitic. And, you know, the whole purpose of interreligious dialogue from a Jewish perspective is to neuter, you know, those parts of other religions that aren't friendly for Jews. And because Jews are so verbally gifted, have such high verbal IQs, because Jews are cohesive and intelligent and organized, because Jews have so much energy and drive and diligence, you know, we've been very successful in the United States in making, you know, any kind of anti-Jewish sentiment completely unacceptable for a person in public life, you know, so that they have to even water down their Christianity, because from the perspective of Christianity, you know, Jew converting to Christianity would be a perfected Jew. What Ann Coulter said in 2007 is totally normative Christianity, but Jews have been very successful in creating an America where members of religions are willing to kind of sacrifice what their key religious tenets for the sake of, you know, getting along in this tolerant, multicultural country that's being created from what was dominantly a 90% white and dominantly Protestant country.
I'm sure a lot of these refugees coming in from the Middle East are not too fond of the Jews.
No, they hate Jews, but these refugees aren't very smart. Like, the average Syrian IQ is somewhere between 79 and 83. So they're never going to be organized enough.
But
to, like,
what about
Jews in a gas chamber?
What about Steve Jobs? He was Syrian.
Well, of course, there are always outliers, but anecdotes don't, you know, disprove general facts.
Maybe Sheldon Adelson should have to house the refugees at his Venetian casino. Then it would be a much more authentic Italian experience.
Yeah. Oh, God. You know, would that all these activists, be they Jewish or not Jewish, you know, let them house, you know, Muslim refugees. Like, I asked a question on my Facebook, would you rather 100 Syrian Muslim refugees, you know, die at sea or move onto your block? And nobody wants to say, I'd rather they die at sea, but Ockerman say, I'd rather they die at sea. I'd rather that black African refugees trying to come into, you know, my block where I live, the choice between them dying at sea or moving onto my block, I'd rather they die at sea. And I think most healthy people would have the same attitude. Most healthy people don't want blacks and Muslims, you know, moving onto their street or into their neighborhood, let alone walking into their home. So all these pro-immigration people, let them house, you know, these immigrant blacks and immigrant Muslims in their own home, you know, around their own daughters and their own wives, and see what happens.
A lot of these Jewish organizations, they like to make comparisons to the famous story where there was that ship of Jewish refugees from Germany that was turned back from the United States.
Yeah, well, they'll use any story that they think is rhetorically effective. So, you know, there were Jewish refugees who wanted to get away from Europe as Hitler was coming to power. That doesn't mean that America or any country had a moral obligation to take them in. Every country has a moral obligation to protect their borders and to only accept those refugees that are in their national interest. So just because there was this ship at St. Louis filled with, you know, Jewish refugees fleeing Hitler and the rise of Hitler in Europe doesn't mean that America had any obligation to take them in or, you know, to take in any other Jews. And also the analogy is just really perverse because the Syrians are not fleeing a genocide. The Africans are not fleeing a genocide. You know, they move through many different countries to settle with the country with the most generous welfare policy. So let's just say that they are fleeing genocide in Syria, but there's not a genocide of Syrians going on in Turkey. Why don't they just stay in Turkey? No, they're not content with staying in Turkey or Libya or, you know, some neighboring country. They want to go to a country like England or Germany, which has the most generous welfare policies. So there's absolutely no comparison between them and Jews following fleeing Europe in the 1930s, but even with Jews fleeing Europe in the 1930s, it's not the obligation of any other country to take in people that may or may not be in their interest to take in. For instance, the United States had huge unemployment in the 1930s. It would not make rational sense for them to take in immigrants. With, you know, 90% of Americans during the 1930s were opposed to further immigration because, you know, America had an unemployment rate, you know, around 20%. So you don't take in immigrants when your native population can't find work. So that's my theory.
So you recently interviewed Roger Devlin about his book Sexual Utopia and Power.
Yes, perhaps as intimidated as I've ever been in conducting an interview. I've read so much of his, and I'm just so impressed by his work.
You said it filled you with rage. Was it eroticized rage or just generic rage?
Well, I think that comment was in reference to a very particular essay he'd written about how men in divorces, you know, are just screwed over by the system and denied, you know, often access to their children. And it's just, you know, it's really an anti-male, how anti-male the divorce courts are. So that was just a pure rage. It wasn't an eroticized rage. It did not give me a chubby.
So one of the comments you made in the interview is like, well, you were talking about how in relationships, first of all, at first you come across as charming and charismatic, but once you get into relationships, you basically become what you would describe as like a beta male.
Yeah, I do have a lot of the beta male in me, and so I just want, you know, I just want an easy time of it. I don't want, you know, fighting or, you know, I have an instinct to just like appease, you know, the girl, so that, you know, we don't have conflict. It's embarrassing, but, you know, there have been times in my life where I've, you know, basically begged for sex. Again, a very beta male thing to do. I put up with, you know, a girlfriend who cheated on me. You know, I've often acted the beta male. You know, at times, it depends on, you know, what the context. I've, you know, had some significant health problems in my life. So when you're, you know, you're so sick that you can't leave your bed, it's very hard to be, you know, an alpha male. And so in more desperate times, my beta male has come out. And in other times, you know, my alpha male has been strong pretty much the whole relationship. So it's varied.
And you said that when you shared something vulnerable and you let out your sensitive side, sometimes that was shown as a sign of weakness.
Yeah. It often was, you know, then used against me, and it helped, you know, the woman develop contempt for me. So it depends on the type of woman, not so much with my Asian experiences. In my experience, you know, the Asian women didn't develop contempt for me. You know, if sometime into the relationship, after it was a sexual relationship, you know, I showed my vulnerable side, they did not use that against me. And so it depends, you know, when in a relationship you do it. If after you're having regular sex with a woman, or, you know, you've had sex just one time, it completely changes the power dynamic of a relationship. And so then, you know, you can move much more into the comfort stage of a relationship rather than trying to, you know, build the attraction. And so I've had girlfriends who use my vulnerability against me, or who it just instinctively filled them with some contempt for me. So that was kind of shocking for me, because, you know, I still had it in my head that, you know, women want you to be honest and open and vulnerable, because I appreciate it when a woman's open, honest, and vulnerable. And for me, that's kind of, you know, the whole point of a relationship is to have someone that you can be vulnerable with, to share things that you wouldn't share with anyone else. To me, still, that feels like, you know, the major point of a relationship. So if the vulnerability, you know, builds their contempt, then it's very troubling. And so the easy way out, which for me is to be vulnerable. You know, in my relationships, I want to be vulnerable. I want to be open. I don't want to be hiding things. I don't want to be projecting an aloof course self that is not natural to me. But on the other hand, if that just breeds contempt, then one has to act against one's comfortable inclinations, and it means that you may need to reserve that vulnerable part of yourself for your male, certain male friends, or your therapist.
Yeah. And you were also saying you date a lot of women in their 30s, and they basically are done with sex. And you say the earlier women become sexually active, the more likely they're burnt out.
Yeah, I've noticed that. The more, the earlier women become sexually active, say in their teens, the more likely they are to burn out by their, you know, late 20s, often. And as opposed to often, you know, women I've known who did not become sexually active until their 20s. You know, we're talking, say, 21, 22, 20, 23. You know, in their 40s, they're still eager. They're still very sexually eager. So as opposed to, you know, girls who are having sex at 11, 12, 13, 15, they really tend to burn out. You know, by 25, often they're done. They're just not very interested anymore.
As part of this, are you talking about the porn stars you've dated?
No, because they were very enthusiastic in the bedroom. But this is just regular women that I've dated and talked to, and it's fascinating because there are plenty of women who still love sex in their 40s, and I assume there are women who still love sex in their 50s. But from what I gather in life and from what I gather in reading, you know, these are almost always women who waited until they're at least 20 or so before they became sexually active. And also, the more lovers that a woman's had, you know, the more, you know, degraded she is. So, you know, once she crosses the Rubicon, you know, she's almost a lost cause. You know, the ideal number of lovers that your future wife has is zero or one, just you. And once you go past two or three, she's a really bad bet for marriage stability and for forming any kind of long-term marriage commitment with someone like that. So, you know, it seems like most women these days ride the cock carousel, to use the words of Chateau Artiste, in their late teens, early 20s. You know, a woman who's had 10 lovers, she's, you know, a really bad bet to marry. And you know, almost every woman out there on the dating market, you know, has had, you know, at least, you know, 10 lovers, it seems like. And, you know, you have very poor odds of forming a lasting relationship with someone who's had that much cock. It just does something to their brain and to their chemistry. It never seems to do anything good. And, you know, every lover that a woman takes on, it, you can see how it degrades her. You can see it in her facial features. You can see it in her walk. You can see it in, you know, the way she talks and in her values. You know, I've noticed that once a woman's had, you know, several lovers, she finds it, you know, very hard not to get pushed into the bedroom again. You know, she's just on that cock carousel, and it's, you know, very hard for her to get off until she is just burned out and lost all interest in sex. And then, you know, what kind of loser will marry a woman like that? So, yeah, you know, so many women out there, you know, they're pump and dump women, in the words of Chateau Artiste. You know, no sane man would want to form a long-term relationship with a girl who's had, you know, 10 or more lovers. It's just nuts.
What are your thoughts on people who date interracially? Do you think there's a difference between men and women in their choices who date outside their group?
Oh, yeah. White women are the most selective. You know, only fat white women basically date black men, with very few exceptions. So the white-black is the most dramatic difference. So I think it's a real shame when people marry outside of their race. I just feel an instinctive revulsion. It's kind of like a betrayal of their ancestors. I'm talking here mainly about the, you know, say the black-white difference. That's the most dramatic. I still think it's a shame when whites and Asians marry and have kids. It's a shame for the kids, because the kids won't fit in either with the whites or with the Asians, and mixed race kids have a much more difficult time in life. They're much more likely to commit suicide, much more likely to be in crime, they're much more likely to be depressed. It's bad for kids. So, you know, I think black people should, you know, marry black people and be proud of their blackness and, you know, make black babies. I think whites should mate with whites, Jews should mate with Jews, and, you know, Asians with Asians. But, you know, I don't feel as much of a negative, I don't feel the revulsion, you know, when it's, you know, a white and a, say, and someone from China. Now, that's very typical. You'll see a white male with an Oriental woman. I don't feel that, you know, strong revulsion, even though I think it's ideal that the races marry within their own people.
Well, one thing that's important to point out is, like, Philip Rushton has this R selection, K selection theory, and the key difference is blacks are the most R selected, and you can make an argument that Asians are even more K-selected than whites.
Oh, they are more K-selected than whites. I mean, Asians, you know, do K-selected means parental investment in children. So Asians have fewer children, generally speaking, than do whites. They invest more in their kids. And, I mean, you can just see this if you know Asians. They invest, you know, more in their kids. They nurture them more than white parents do. They're more protective of their kids than white parents do. And then whites tend to have fewer children than blacks and to have higher parental investment than blacks. So it's Phil Rushton's rule of threes that on so many life results, Asians fall out on one end, blacks fall out on the opposite end, whites are in the middle but closer to Asians than they are to blacks.
Are some ethnic groups, which ones are the most and least promiscuous?
Well, East Asians are the least promiscuous, but in some measures, Jews are the least likely to get in trouble sexually, in the sense of, out of wedlock births. That's a very rare, comparatively rare thing in Jewish life. So, by some measures, East Asians are the least likely to have, you know, the sexual trouble with STDs and out of wedlock births. But by other measures, Jews are the least likely to have these troubles. So it depends on the specific type of measurement. Either way, Jews and East Asians tend to be the smartest in the way they conduct themselves sexually, or the most cautious.
And the thing is, like, you make this point, the more people are feel bonding with other people, the more responsible they are in their behavior. People who lack bonds have no limits to what kind of degeneracy they can engage in.
Yeah, and a key component of bonds is racial. So, you know, if you mate with someone of your own race, you're more likely to behave, you know, responsibly than if you mate outside your race. For instance, there's a saying in Jewish life that shiksa is for practice. That means, you know, you can pump and dump them, but don't commit, and, you know, definitely don't marry them. So that kind of attitude breeds a callousness towards sex and towards using people that is much less likely to be there when you have a strong genetic kinship with other people. So in this, you know, city of Los Angeles, where there's so much racial diversity, you also have incredible perversion and crime and disgusting behavior, because people so rarely know, have that strong genetic kinship with people they interact with. So it's easy to go out and pump and dump, whether you're pumping someone with bullets or with your sperm. When you're keeping it within your tribe, within your people, you're going to be much more responsible. You're much more likely to have people in common. You're much more likely to have bonds. The rate of criminal violence committed by interracial couples is much, much higher than when couples marry within their race. So I'm primarily talking about if someone takes on a black spouse, their odds of being assaulted or having something, criminally violent done to them by that black spouse is just, many times that of a, if they chosen someone within their race.
Roger Devlin was making the argument that materialism coincides with sexual degeneracy. And I think in general, in a lot of cases, he is right, because our popular culture promotes both consumerism and sexual degeneracy, but there are some exceptions. And you make the point that Orthodox Judaism is, they're, first of all, they're heavily urban, and they're also major consumers, but they're also very socially conservative.
Yeah, I mean, most Orthodox Jews are virgins when they get married. And almost all Orthodox Jews live in urban areas, and say, for instance, modern Orthodox Jews enjoy an average household income of about $120,000, which would, be probably three times the rate for the average goy.
So you're poor by Orthodox standards.
Yeah. But they also, they're very sexually responsible, generally speaking. You have a very low rate of out-of-wedlock births in Orthodox Judaism. So I don't buy Roger Devlin's argument that there's a strong connection between materialism, consumerism, and sexual promiscuity, because it's just not true in Orthodox Jewish life.
I do think it's true in regards to upper middle class secular people.
Maybe, but I'd have to see studies. It's upper class people who are overwhelmingly getting married, staying married, and having kids, It's the working class whites who are unable to get married or sustain marriages. People in the upper classes are much more stable families and are much more likely to marry than working class whites.
Well, you have a lot of upper middle class white women, as you would say, riding the cock carousel and like delaying marriage till they're well into their 30s.
I'd have to see statistics, but I bet you that, women who come from families, that are millionaires, behave much more sexually responsibly than women who come from families where the average annual household income was below $50,000. So that's my sense of things. I don't know the statistics, but that's my sense.
So, you have this post when beta males go on a shooting spree, and this is in reference. There was this Korean man in Oakland who was studying at a nursing school, and he went on a shooting spree there.
Yeah, so I love the blog Chateau Hartiste, which is hartiste.wordpress.com, hearteiste.wordpress.com, and he makes the argument that beta males, because they're so sexually frustrated, are more likely to act out with criminal violence. I think that may be right, but I think what's more important here is that people who lack bonds are more likely to behave in socially destructive ways. So for me, the most important thing about people like this shooter and other shooters of his ilk is that they lack sustainable, appropriate, nurturing relationships of any kind, forget sex. If this person had been bonded, closely to a community, to very good friends, I think he'd be much less likely to do this. So for me, the outstanding characteristic from what I just gather anecdotally about, these rampage killers is that they're loners. And that's the problem. Lack of bonds permits people to do, you know, horrible, horrible, horrible things that they would not do if they just had, you know, two good friends. And so for me, that lack of ties to other people is more important than their lack of sex life. You know, probably the most productive people over the past 2,000 years who made the biggest impact on the world have perhaps, you know, not had a sex life. And so I don't think, I'm not sure I agree with Royce and Chateau Artis that the lack of sex life is the main problem with these paper nails. For me, it's the lack of human connection and bonds that predisposes people to act terribly.
Yeah, I basically agree with you. Some of these bloggers are very much reductionists. They reduce everything to sex. I think the sexual thing adds fuel to the fire, the eroticized rage. But the key thing is these people lack attachment. And I think you're seeing the reason we're seeing these shootings is because society is becoming a lot more atomized.
Yeah, like I haven't had sex in, you know, almost 6 years. And, you know, I'm fine. You know, I've only gotten happier over the last 6 years. My life has only improved over the last 6 years. You know, of course, I'd love to get married and be in a sexual relationship with my wife. And of course, you know, there have been numerous times when I could have had sex over the past 6 years, you know, if I was willing to, you know, lower my standards and, you know, degrade myself. You know, I could have gone Mexican, you know, any time. I could have gone black any time. I, you know, could have, you know, hooked up with some fat white chick. But I had, you know, more self-respect. And, you know, for me, completely just, you know, ending the masturbation, you know, over 3 years now and, you know, ending the promiscuous sex and, you know, I have more self-respect. And if I find a good woman that I can marry, you know, I'll be thrilled to be sexually active again. But, for me, you know, sex, you know, probably only troubles me, you know, torments me in my mind, you know, 5, 10, 15 minutes a day. And, you know, that's it. And the rest of the time I'm, you know, pretty calm and placid. So when I meet a quality woman, you know, I'm ready for that long-term relationship, but I'm not going to debase myself as, you know, I have at times in the past. So I don't think a lack of sex, you know, causes one to be unhappy. What causes one to be unhappy is a lack of meaningful attachments to other people. If you have meaningful friendships and a meaningful, you know, place in your community, then as long as you're not an addict to sex and to romance and intrigue, you know, you can lead a happy life. If you are a sex and love addict, then you can find a 12-step program, you can find a good therapist, you can find, you know, you can find help for that.
What have your experiences been using Tinder and JSwipe? I mean, I've checked out both of the sites. I mean,
I've enjoyed it, even though I haven't develop any relationships from it, because I'm a very selective, so always the first question I ask anyone on Tinder or JSwipe is, have you read any good books lately? And that immediately cuts to the chase. You know, I'm either going to be talking to someone who's well-read and likes to talk about books, or I'm not going to be talking, which, you know, of course, usually happens. So I've met interesting women on there. On Tinder, like, very early on, I met this model who was quite erudite. You know, we never went out, but we became friendly, you know, someone who I had interesting conversations with. So when I eventually, you know, get into my next long-term relationship and when I hope to marry, it will be with someone who loves to read books and someone that I can have these types of conversations with. So I enjoy the conversations that I've had on JSwipe and Tinder, and sometimes leading to phone and you know, other means of communication. Nothing's led to a relationship yet, but, you know, I am pretty selective in, who I spend any time or energy with. So I enjoy it. It's not something that I sit down and do. It's just something that I grab when, you know, I'm watching a football game or, you know, when I'm on the phone in a boring conversation or something, you know, then I'll pick up, you know, my phone and do this. So I enjoy the adventure, and I just, you know, enjoy learning about what's going on in the world just by, you know, looking at the pictures and the women select and the way they describe themselves. So I've had, you know, I've met quality people on both Tinder and JSwipe.
Do you think the whole sort of narcissistic supply is a substitute for attachment? I found that to be true in my life. When I'm not feeling a strong sense of attachment, I look towards accomplishments to fill that void.
Yeah, like, you know, when I kind of got my sex and love addiction under control, you know, then my my addiction to attention would, you know, kind of flare its ugly head. So, you know, if I'm not bonded with other people, then the more weird, you know, I become. So, you know, attention seeking and, you know, trying to find ways that you can regard yourself as a, you know, great, great man, you know, who's smarter than everyone else, will likely take over. And when it comes to narcissism, many psychologists don't believe that therapy can help and that the drugs can help. But I do believe that truly working a 12-step program can help someone who's got narcissistic personality disorder, who's got, you know, high levels of narcissism. It, you know, it can reduce someone who's, say, a narcissistic 8 to a narcissistic 4 or 3. You can genuinely change your life with the spiritual approach of a 12-step program that may not be possible with simply psychotherapy or drugs. And, you know, a lot of people have known me for years, you know, would say that I've moved, you know, either from a 9 to a 6 or an 8 to a 5 or, you know, maybe even an 8 to a 4 in the in the narcissistic realm through, you know, working my various 12-step programs.
I know a lot of psychologists have been saying Donald Trump has a narcissistic personality disorder.
Yeah, I'm not sure. See, I guess I'm so focused on him being the only candidate who's really prepared to do something about illegal immigration that, you know, I wouldn't care if he performed abortions in the White House, to quote Ann Coulter. So, yeah, I'm not going to take his psychological inventory. I'm just too enamored with the things he said about building a wall and cracking down on immigration.
So, Luke Ford, it's been a great show.
Good to talk to you, Robert.
Thanks for being on. That's all we have for today's show. So take care, and we'll be back with you next time.